Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the last weekend of December 2025. It's the last weekend of the year. We're now a week past the winter solstice and slowly increasing the length of the days, but still very much in the dark part of the year. Coming off of a rather cold stretch of weather here in December, had a chance to see the sun drop below the horizon. I'd hoped to be able to track it in the days around the solstice, just to see that southernmost transition as it moved further south where it set and came back north. But unfortunately, there were some cloud banks on the horizon, so despite clear skies over town, I didn't have a chance to see that. But I hope you've been getting out and enjoying the weather, whatever it holds. And love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can get on my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a comment there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded earlier this month with Brooke Schaefer and Paul Norwood. Over the past few years, I've enjoyed having them as guests for my New Year's show, and this year is no different. We talked about some of the exploration and adventuring they've been doing over the past year and some of what I've been doing as well. Hope you enjoy this conversation.
We actually didn't get out that much this year. Both Paul and I had busier schedules than usual, so we didn't get out for kind of like big adventures in the sense that we usually do. But as we often do when we reflect on the year, we find out that we certainly got out in fun and interesting ways and saw a lot of interesting things and had a great time, even if they were shorter events than usual. And I think like Paul has a great example in terms of scuba diving this year, because that was something you were able to do frequently. You don't have to go too far for that, and there's so much to explore down there. So yeah, I think we managed to do a fair amount.
So yeah, I've seen Paul's photos coming in iNaturalist. I think you have some like 6,000 observations in Alaska this year, and
all right,
most of them from Sitka, and probably most of them from underwater. Based on the, it'll be a, I was like, oh, Paul must have went diving again. There's another observation dump of 100 to 200 observations of bright and colorful things coming through. Lots of reds and oranges and pinks, and
so much he can see it so much now. Like before, it's sort of like seeing things you've already seen, is you know when you go hiking and things like that. But now this is kind of like a new world for Paul.
It really is. It's amazing down there. And like Brooke was saying, our schedules were not as friendly as usual this year. And also the times that we had off didn't really overlap very well. And so we would have some days off, but they were never the same, unfortunately. So going diving became more of a possibility, because you need half a day to a full day and another, you know, fellow diver, and then you can go. And it's amazing. I mean, if you imagine just being a fish and you built a contraption that allowed you to go on land for an hour at a time, and then the highest you can go is 130 feet above sea level. That's the absolute highest in your technology, your fish technology. And then you can only see things that are just a few feet away from you, really. And it's dark most of the time. So you're walking around at night in the woods, and you've never been in the woods, and you don't know what trees look like, and you don't know what deer look like, and you're only there for an hour. How much are you really going to see? And how are you going to, like, handle this? So first of all, you're not going to see the mountains, really. But you might be able to find some of those, like, places that have cliffs by the seaside that maybe have mountain species. Maybe you'll run into something really cool, like, oh, my God, there's a bear. Or you'll just go into a meadow and, like, I've never seen an iris before. This is crazy. So it's, and there's also seasons, and you're not aware of the seasons because you've always been underwater. So it's pretty cool. It's that, but the opposite. And the ocean is infinite and gigantic. And, you know, it's the other two-thirds of the Earth, as some people say. But, yeah, very, very, very cool.
Yeah, and I hadn't really thought about it until I was just, like, reflecting on, like, I'd pull up the identification screen for Sitka observations, and then they'd all be, like, pink and orange and yellow, and I'd be like, oh, Paul's been diving again.
So and colorful.
Yeah, well, there's no green. Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, which, I mean, you mentioned that it's dark down there, but still everything is so colorful when you bring a light to it.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's interesting how what colors there are, though, because the land stuff's all green. I mean, not entirely green, but almost all green, you know, the plants and things like that.
But fish would be like, oh my God, all these wild greens up there.
Yeah.
It's crazy. There's like bright green, dull green. And we just think about, oh, it's green. Of course it's green. You know, we take it for granted because we live in this green world. And then they take it for granted because they live in this pink and orange and yellow world.
Well, and I suppose that has to do with the wavelengths that attenuate more quickly in the water column.
Yeah.
And so... you know, you don't have the green algae below pretty, I mean, I don't know what the zone is for green algae, but it's pretty high, I guess.
Yeah, it doesn't go down super. Codium goes down fairly deep, but other than codium, green algae don't go very deep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of, interesting to consider what might be driving that. But there have been, I mean, I don't know if you've kept track of how many new species. I know there's been several sort of like, we'll call them minor range extensions of a couple hundred miles. Things that, you know, probably aren't too surprising just because of how little effort's been put in here. Still, fun to get new species for Alaska and that kind of a thing.
I think it's good to just... fill in the range maps, because usually the range maps, when you read a book, it sounds so neat. You know, you're reading this book and it says, found from Sitka, Alaska to Ensenada, Mexico. And you're like, oh, okay, so it's everywhere between Sitka, Alaska and Ensenada, Mexico. But the reality of it is, someone saw it in Sitka in 87. Someone saw it in Ensenada in 1951. And then there's a bunch of observations in California, a few in Oregon. And nobody really knows where they are in Alaska. So it's really good and important work. For example, one of our commonest fish, the black-eyed goby, in a lot of the books, it says the northern range, edge of the range is Sitka. And you see thousands. Of course, they're north of here. Just nobody looks for them.
Yeah. Well, and to be fair, it's a lot of coastline that doesn't have a lot of people north of here.
Mm-hmm.
So it is an interesting thing. You know, when you have the accessibility via diving, you know, I suppose tide pooling has become a lot less appealing. I'm sure there's still things that you would find tide pooling, you know, turning over rocks and things that, and digging in the mud, especially perhaps, that you wouldn't necessarily find diving. But the diversity that you can access via diving seems to be a lot greater than what you would.
Yeah, it's different for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And things are happier. It seems like, you know, when I look at your pictures, the fish don't look like they're, you know, trying to get away, and all of the things, like when you find them in a tide pool and they're trying to find a rock to hide under, you know, it seems like for the most part, and that's what I'm kind of curious about. I mean, are they afraid of you? It doesn't, Maybe a lot of them are, I guess, but the ones you have pictures of aren't. I suppose the ones that are afraid, you don't
get
pictures
of. Yeah, it seems
of,
like but. Some fish are always afraid. Some fish we just don't see. Like, I've only ever seen one halibut. Mm-hmm. And it's not like halibut are rare, but I've only ever seen one halibut diving. Some fish just don't care at all. And some fish might even be attracted by divers that, like, bump into things.
Okay.
Like in the surge zone during a safety stop. And, you're, like, bumping into things and it causes some disturbance and, like, surf perch will show up. And then at nighttime, there's some fish that just will chill. And then in the daytime, you can't find them. And then vice versa also.
Interesting. So different habits. And how much... How patchy are you finding the habitats for, you know, there's obviously the broad categories of muddy or sandy bottom, rocky, sort of vertical rock or horizontal rock and that kind of thing. But are you finding that, you know, you're finding very different assemblages of organisms at different places? Because I know you've been diving, you know, generally close to town.
Yeah.
And sometimes from the road system, sometimes from a boat, but still just different places. I don't know how much, like in the forest here, it's relatively uniform. You'll find a little spot mm-hmm. here and there that's got an interesting little microhabitat or something. But I don't know how uniform it is under the water.
I'm not 100% sure either. I think it's comparable to land. Like, you know, you go to cruise off and then you'll find like a, I don't know, like a selaginella or something that you haven't found here, you know, and like maybe Miracagale or some other sweet gale, you know, some other things that you can't find in town. And I think it's similar, just like bat stars, for example, a very obvious easy to identify the bad stars as starfish, and it tends to be of very many colors. And Brooke and me saw many, many of them down in Prince of Wales and surrounding areas. And they're, you know, people take pictures of them. They're like, oh, bad stars, great for Instagram. Like, they're very common. But in Sitka, I have never seen one. But then we did a dive by Frosty Reef, and all of a sudden I saw like 8.
Whoa.
So
wait,
they're down there.
That's a range extension then.
I don't know. I think they were sort of known from here, but nobody really knew where in Sitka. And I wonder exactly where they are and where they aren't. And so it's kind of that same thing of like you're the fish with your contraption. You go on land one time and you find something. And you're like, oh, sweet gale. This is the end of the sweet gale. Like, how many more little expeditions do you have to do to be sure? I don't know. But it's a little bit similar to our finding of the... Salal, for sure, is down in that area. But same area. I know you're completely correct. So Salal is at the northern edge of the Salal. It's kind of around the hot springs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think there might... Yeah, Redoubt Lake... And it's patchy in there. Like, there's places where it is, and there's quite a bit of it. And then, like, I've walked around at the hot springs and didn't find any. Mm-hmm. But I think somebody's found it a little north of the hot springs, and definitely folks have found it south of the hot springs. Actually, it's quite a bit further south of the hot springs.
Yeah, huge patches that you have to, like, fight your way through.
Well, it depends on where you are, because I was well south of the hot springs this summer and didn't see any. Down by Byron Bay. So, and maybe it needed to be a little lower, maybe, like, there was some closer to sea level because we were up at around 400 feet, kind of in a it was rolling benchy area. It's like, but so I don't know. I have yet to run into Salal, and I remember you all had found it. I guess probably was it on that old trail to Redoubt?
So Seven Fathom Bay is the best place to find it.
All right,
it's
and I've been down
all over the place.
That was before I started, you know, knowing what Salal was or to look for it. The last time I was in Seven Fathom Bay was 1999. So. Mm-hmm. It's on my list of when I get down there. And so, we made that trip down there. There was a kind of a group trip. Matt Muir was in town and went to the Tom Young Cabin and the hot springs down there. And I specifically, poked around. I walked up to the muskeg around the hot spring. I didn't see any Salal.
Yeah.
Any Salal.
It's more like
there.
South of Big Bay.
Yeah.
But this is where we found and made another similar range extension for... It's not so much a range extension. It's more like confirming where it was, but nobody had really like good data for it. The feather boa kelp,
right.
Another charismatic macroorganism.
Yeah, that one was pretty interesting. Matt Muir timed his visit here for low tide series. Or maybe you invited some folks
and he came down
and you timed it for low tide series and said, hey, let's go to Tom Young Cabin if you want to come. And so I think it was the two of you and me, Kitty LeBounty and Matt Muir. Is that everybody?
That's everyone, yeah.
Yeah.
And so spent a couple nights there, if I remember. And had the low tide in the morning and went around. And the feather boa kelp, it was just on one stretch of beach. Rocky stretch over maybe 50 yards, maybe not even that. And there were several patches of it looking very happy. But I walked further down the beach and didn't see any. And, you know, the other side of the beach, there wasn't any. So I don't know what it was, but something about that spot liked it. So it's interesting how these things can be quite patchy, especially probably towards the northern edge. Like in your mind, you're like range, it just fades out. But what does that actually mean in practice?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
know?
And so it you know, needs, I guess, maybe microsites that are specific, I mean, especially, you know, favorable to it to survive or something like that. I don't know how that works, but it is, the bat stars at Frosty Reef and it'd be interesting, you know, how deep were they? Because you were finding them on Prince of Wales intertidally, right?
Mm-hmm. So, yes, but they're also, kayaking is a good way to find them because they do get pretty big and they grow pretty deep. And so I wonder if... diving will reveal more populations.
How deep did you go at Frosty Reef when you were diving and found them?
Oh, it was a shallowish dive, like maybe 80 feet. But we didn't find those. We found just the bat stars. So I wonder where else they are. And there's so many places unexplored. And it's so easy to just assume that something isn't here, because if you were to just live in Sitka and never leave Sitka Sound, you'd think there is no dragon kelp here.
Hmm.
Like none. And then you go to Peril Straits, you go down to like Redfish Bay. Yeah, and there's huge patches of dragon kelp. And it's not hiding. They're like 100 feet long.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the eternal question for me, you know, land and sea is like, why here? Why not there? There are things like red paintbrush, for example, you can find on the east side of the island. There it grows over by Lake Eva,
yeah,
on the beach.
Pumpkinberry
mm-hmm. over at Red Bluff Bay. And the red paintbrush in particular is throughout Southeast Alaska, but not in Sitka. I've never found it right around Sitka. I've never found it mm-hmm. on Kruzoff, never found it along the road system. And it's all over Prince of Wales. It's mm-hmm. like on the outer coast. You're like, well, maybe it doesn't like the outer coast, but it's on the outer coast of Prince of Wales, as best I can tell, all around on the interior. So it's like, why not here? The Douglas maples, another one. You're like, well,
they're gross. You'd think they would be so happy, like in the Magoons, those Douglas yeah. maples. Because they're so happy by Lake Eva. They're all over QU. And they're not here.
Yeah. That just makes me wonder, like, what is it that's limiting them? What keeps them from getting established here? And yeah, there's a number of plants that are like that. It's like, why not?
Yeah, for sure.
Or conversely, you know, why so abundant in this place? And why not? You know, there's a yellow flower that's all over on Kruzoff Apergidium or Northern Microceros, different common names is uh-huh. Microceros borealis.
It looks like kind of
it's a dandelion-ish.
Skinny dandelion.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. And it grows over there. It's super common in the muskegs over there. I did finally find it along the road system at the new section of the cross trail off of Old Sitka. Going up that way, there's a section of muskeg there where it grows. And so but I've never seen it in any of the other muskegs around town. There's an orchid that grows on the muskeg by Beaver Lake, Spiranthes. It also grows around Kruzoff, and it grows some other places, but that's the only place around Sitka that I know that it grows. So it's just like, you know, what is it about those places? And then on the other hand, there's an orchid that now is in Totem Park, Goodyear, the rattlesnake plantain.
Oh, yeah, Goodyear repens. And yeah. that is an easy thing to find because you can find its leaves almost all year
round. Yeah, it's evergreen. So it's Goodyear oblongifolia is the one that we have here.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And then... But it wasn't there. So Kitty LeBounty did like plant surveys and I don't know, it'd been almost 20 years ago now. Well, pretty much 20 years ago now, and wasn't there. And then a couple years later, you know, she found one mm-hmm. and like pointed it out to me. It's like, oh, there's a Goodyear here. And it was Goodyear is common other places. You can find it on the islands and things. And there was no reason that it wouldn't be along the road system, but nobody had ever found it as far as I know. I certainly hadn't. And then now there's a bunch of it. And it, from that first plant, you know, there's probably 20 or 30 plants in that kind of area of the park.
And then for our listeners, just like, you know, you're thinking like orchids and orchid leaves, that this is kind of a weird orchid in that it's almost easier to identify the leaves than the flowers.
Oh, for sure. Right? The flowers are kind of inconspicuous. They're just a spike with kind of plain white small flowers. But the leaves are relatively large, I'd say 2 to 3 inches long, and they have this almost variegated kind of patterning, light and dark green on them. And they're pretty, and they just grow as a little basal rosette, the leaves do. And yeah, so they're distinctive enough, and that one clearly, like it wasn't there, and then it was, and then it spread. And so whatever conditions or just happenstance allowed it to get started, and then once it was there, it seems like things were happy. Sometimes maybe that's mycorrhizal fungi, present or absent, because like orchids in particular need specific fungi to get started. So it is a little bit of a mystery and will remain so, no doubt. I think probably a lot of these things are difficult, if not impossible, to tease out.
Some of it, though, I think of a little bit like from the gardener's perspective and how you, to nurture certain plants along, you know, you end up doing special work for the soil, you know, and bringing in special things. And it's relatively a small thing that you do to help a plant out, but it really can be the difference between what allows that plant in your garden to thrive versus... eke along or not make it at all. And so, yeah, when you think about, okay, there might have been an abundance of blank in the soil for some weird reason at this time, and that was what it needed to make
it. Yeah, it is I don't know.
Yeah, right. Lots of things.
And there's different plants at different places. And, you know, animals that can move around, you're like, okay, well, maybe that's a little different. It is interesting to think about, like, well, and I suppose that's one of the interesting things about the diving part is that there's more vertebrates because you have so many fish. And so there's something about that, plus, you know, incredible amounts of invertebrates. And it just, it feels to me like the ocean is more diverse here than the land is. Plants excepted, I suppose. You know, there's if we're just looking at animals,
if you're counting lichens and mosses, but also same thing if you're counting. I mean, it depends on how. I mean, the numbers become so overwhelming so quickly that it's just hard to really know.
Probably restricting ourselves to macro animals, you know, then the ocean would seem to be more diverse than the land. You know, we have insects here, and we have. Not that many vertebrates, birds moving through or whatever, but the ocean seems to be abundant with animals that you can see without a microscope. I'm sure it's abundant with, well, it's definitely abundant with animals that you can see with a microscope too.
Yeah, but. I suspect that our marine fishes list is about comparable to our bird list for the state, except that the bird list is much more comprehensive.
Yeah.
So there's many undiscovered, unnamed, you know, unconfirmed marine fishes in Alaska, in spite of the commercial fisheries and such, whereas there's probably not that many birds that haven't been reported yet in the state.
Yeah.
I mean, although, you know, it seems like Connor has a knack for adding to the list.
Yes, he didn't find a new one this year, but a third record and a second record this year he spotted both of, so... You know, old hat for him, but they were exciting for me because I hadn't ever seen a second record in Alaska. I think the best I'd done previously was maybe a fourth or a seventh record or something like that.
But, which one was the second record?
The snowy plover up in, we went to Sea Lion Cove. I'd been telling him for a long time I wanted to go up to Sea Lion Cove, and he's like, oh. And then he had a day off this summer, and it's like, okay, we'll go up there. And it's a lot nicer dropping in at the end of the road. You save yourself an hour of run time, basically. And it's about an hour, a little over an hour run in his boat to get up to Kalinin Bay. And we went in there and hiked across. The Trail Works was working on the trail at the time, and it's been, boy, the last time I was up there was 2011, so it's been a long time. I was interested, you know, I was kind of up at the Beach Meadow part. It's a big flat kind of meadowy area up there, and this was June, so stuff was going, but not like, I mean, later in the summer probably would have been better for that Beach Meadow. But yeah, I noticed Connor acting a little weird on the beach, and I think he might have started waving to me or something, and there was a bird down there, and it was this snowy plover that was on the beach. There was one prior record from, I think, Hinchinbrook Island or something, Prince William Sound, on a sandy beach. It was a white sandy beach. I think there's another white sandy beach on Cruise Off. I think that Gilmer Bay, north of Gilmer Bay. I think that one's white sand as well, but there's not many white sand beaches around
on the
Sitka.
Outside.
Yeah. And most of our beaches around here around Sitka proper are black sand. But this bird blends in with the white sand. I mean, that's where they winter, and I think they nest when they nest on the coast is the white sand beaches. And when it stopped moving, it was just like, wait, where'd it go? So if you weren't keeping an eye on it, it was pretty remarkable.
But, and where are they typically? What is their range typically?
Much further south. You know, typical, it looks like many years they get to Vancouver Island, but that's kind of the northernmost. There's a outer coast beach there where there's a lot of records from. But they're only, I mean, they're considered threatened, I think, even. Their population isn't super high. I mean, it's still in the tens of thousands, but they, as my recollection is, they winter on the west coast, but they'll go inland. You know, some of them are going inland to breed, nest around lakes and places inland. So this one was just kind of extra far north for normal. And so that was kind of a
cool,
exciting summer find for us. Yeah, that was in June, I guess.
And so. This is a harder place for people to go check out. So maybe you didn't hear much news about it. Like, do you know if it lingered or did you didn't hear?
No, I don't know if anybody else was there.
Up there.
How many people came down, do you think, for the Dick Sissel and the Harris's Sparrow, which, by the way, were... I have no bird patience. I can't stand there and wait. And so I was missing these birds. And then one day Brooke looks out the window and says, look at this bird over there. Is this the rare bird? And I looked and both of them were on the same branch in our garden.
So cute. Well, on the roadie.
Need Brooke for spotting, I guess. Yeah, there was one person that came down the next day, the day after we first reported it. There was five people that came down the day after that. Then the first person came back again because he didn't see the Dickcissel. So he came back again on the Saturday. And he ended up getting a lesser blackback gull while he was here, which was also a new state bird for him while he was here that day because he got the Dickcissel early in the morning. That was actually the last time it was reported. I'd heard that it was seen around, but I'm not sure. There was nobody documented or anything. And interestingly, one showed up at a feeder in Prince of Wales.
I wonder if it's the same one.
Yeah, that was the question. It's like, you know, if this one is left, then it might have moved south. And because it would be remarkable if two showed up, given that there's only been two prior records at all. And, you know, the timing is suggestive that maybe, I mean, it's hard to know unless they could compare in like individual feathers or something like that on the pictures. I don't know if there's enough documentation to do that, but it is it is interesting. And the Harris's sparrow, I haven't been looking for it the last few days, so I'm not sure. But and of course we're recording this in early December, so by the time this airs at the end of the month, it may be
there'll be other rare birds by then.
Could be, yeah.
It was pretty fun when the timing of this bird, because we had some guests that were staying at our house when all these people were coming down to look for the bird, and every time we would come out of our yard to go somewhere, there'd be this group just down the street, you know, with giant cameras and binoculars and our friends just thought it was kind of comical. And it was kind of funny when you think about like a group of people standing in front of a person's yard, essentially, where they could also see into the house, you know, and everything. But it was just normal behavior for birders. And but our friends were struck by like, yeah, every time we went out there, there was a crowd, a small crowd, five to seven people just standing in the road looking at like literally every time in the day when it was daylight we went out, there was people
out there. Evans's yard. Yes. And so they were very kind.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was nice to do that. And then there was one other person that came just this past week. A couple weeks later, and he didn't have high hopes.
We did chat with one guy standing in front of the Evans's yard who was kind of chagrined at the moment because he was like, no Dickcissel yet. And I wonder if it was this gentleman because it was towards the end of our friend's visit. It was maybe even after they left on like Sunday or something.
Yeah, that was probably the guy from Anchorage that came much later. And there are a few long staying rare birds, but mostly birds, like if you want to see them, then you got to go. And you got to go, the sooner the better. And that's why I always hope that people, when they see a rare bird, will tell me about it right away.
Because also, a lot of times, even if they don't move on, they don't fit in, they're maybe not in their best shape, and a raptor ends up getting
them. Yeah, I think that's probably what happened with the rustic bunting that was here earlier this year, a raptor or a cat. Either one, it was pretty around for, I don't know, a couple of weeks, and then like just gone. And so, yeah, those kind of things, you just never know. And so, yeah, it's for somebody who likes to see and document all the things like me, there's nothing quite as frustrating as if only I'd known a little bit sooner.
So word to everyone in Sitka, if you see that weird bird,
let Matt know.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not so far. Nothing is so far that if it turns out to be a normal bird, it's all easy to get to. It's not like I'm dropping tons of miles or money to hop on a flight somewhere. But then, yeah, there are people that will do that once the bird's reported and documented and, they have some confidence that it'll be here. And it's just part of the game, you know, that people are playing. So we all have our different games, I guess, that we like to play. And I chase around Sitka, but I won't go any, you know, I don't really travel much certainly don't travel to chase birds at this point. So, but yeah, those folks that are getting up, some of them over 400 species in Alaska, it's difficult to find a new species, and you almost have to chase, or you just have to hang out someplace like Gamble or, the Aleutians, or Hyder or wherever, and hope for the best, you know, during the peak seasons for unusual birds. So, but yeah, it is interesting. I guess last year we talked about your sort of trip up the ridge between Lisa Creek and Catlian.
Oh yeah.
And I think you at the time were talking about doing a longer, like, circumnavigation essentially of the Lisa Creek drainage from the Catlian side. And if I remember seeing the iNaturalist observations come in on the map, I was like, oh, they made it back. So how was that?
It turns out that's more like of the ridge up there. I would describe it as a W.
Okay.
I think we had talked about it maybe as a big U, and we were planning to, we had gone up the ridge closest to Cedar Cove side, and we were kind of going to do the big U. But when you look at the map, and then when we got on the ground, there's actually a middle ridge between those two. And so we ended up going up that middle ridge and then connecting it around to the initial ridge we had done. So we did just part of the big, there's still so much more up there to explore and see. But we just ended up doing that middle ridge, which is just great. You know, it's so lovely up there getting on the ridge. You get up relatively high. I think the highest point was 3,200 feet. So like Bear Mountain, right?
Bear is 42 at the top.
So
32 is like, yeah, Mount Edgecombe or Verstovia's, Harbor Mountain. The peaks are kind of around that.
Yeah. But no, no like treacherous cliffs or any.
It's a very nice continuous ridge.
Oh, man.
Just fun to walk. Just goes on and on and on.
Maybe just a little tricky to get up and a little tricky to get down. But we have this new theory now after having explored the middle ridge and the ridge closest to like Catlian side. It looks like the old logging road would be really easy to access from Nakwasina. And we have an idea that standing up on that middle ridge, looking down into the valley between the middle ridge and then the far one closer to Nakwasina, it looks like that logging road, you can see potentially that it goes pretty far up that kind of valley, almost to the end of the forest line. And that once you come to that point, then you know it's pretty clear walking. You can just walk yourself right up to a lake that's back there. So I think we're kind of thinking now the new thing to do is to explore getting up more quickly via that route, like seeing if the logging road really is clear enough and, you know, open enough to access and can get us high enough that we can then walk pretty quickly up to the ridge. Because on our way down, we thought we were going to take a quicker way down, and that was just terrible, just a terrible way down. And then our way up, I would say, was good, but we wonder if this would even be quicker.
Yeah.
So there's still so much, obviously, everywhere. There's so much more to explore, but I feel like, what are your thoughts, Paul? Like, I just feel like there's still so much potential back there.
Oh, yeah. And I think the best thing is going to be to go overnight, because our main obstacle has been that we usually go up to Cedar Cove, spend the night, and then we get up in the morning and we're like, oh, we're going to have some coffee and hang out. It's going to be great. And then it's kind of late by the time we get started. So I think the best thing would be to go up and camp by the lake and do some more thorough exploration once up there.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I wouldn't surprise me if folks, hunters especially, are using the logging road from Lisa Creek, I guess. I think there's some private property that's over on that side by the mouth of Lisa Creek. And
On the Nakwasina
side. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And I'm not sure. They may even been kept open for ATVs in places. I'm not sure.
It doesn't look super ATV friendly.
Yeah.
Not the ones we have walked on, but.
Yeah, there's a lot of those places back there. Sometimes the roads are. I remember coming down the South Fork of Catlian and hiked over to that. This was in the 90s, and the logging road, like the animals, there was just a path on it that I think the animals used, and so it had mostly gotten overgrown, but it was an easy walking path because it was flat. You know, it was still early enough in the. I mean, it was 30 years later, but early enough in the it was still alders, and the alders hadn't started falling down yet, so the ground was flat, which makes a big difference. Well, speaking of which, I recently found von Kittlitz was a German naturalist that came here in 1827 and spent 5 weeks, and he wrote a big, you know, my travels around the world kind of account of his trips, and so there's a section on the time in Sitka, and it was in German, and I could never you know, when I first found out about it and looked at it, it's like I don't read German, and the script was all funky. Like, I didn't even know how to read the script, basically. It's kind of this old Gothic style stuff, and so I don't even know how to interpret the letters. But recently I was like, oh, I wonder if Google has gotten better, like AI or something. I thought, well, maybe if I can find this. So I looked for it, and then I found several copies of it, digital editions, you know, because the Google especially, but other companies were scanning all the books. And so you can find the scanned, and there's actually text, the text of it. And then just using Google Translate, I could translate it into English. So it's like, oh, so I actually read this Funkitlet's account from here. And the thing that was funny to me was, so he was here. The Russians had their Castle Hill and their fortress here. There was the, what now is Totem Park, was the battle site area and stuff. But that was out away from town, you know. And he talks about, you know, he's been to Brazil and, you know, they came from Chile. And he's talking about, you know, how much people warned him about getting through the Salmon Bay thing. He goes, the Salmon Bay thickets weren't so bad. I actually thought this was going to be pretty nice. But very quickly, I changed my mind about all of that, essentially. And he talks about walking back from the mouth of Indian River, basically back to town, and just being utterly exhausted by the trip. He said it was, and to me that's funny because obviously we can walk that super easily, but right. But he was talking about just like all the holes, like there's just, the ground was so uneven, crawling up and over logs and holes between them and all of these things. And I was like, and so he was you know, old school naturalist. He was shooting birds to collect them. They didn't even know what these birds were in many cases, the, you know, new to science kind of birds. And he said, sounded like most of the birds got lost in the bushes. Like, he would shoot them, but he couldn't find them in the bushes, or they'd fall down these holes. And I was like, man, he must have been going the wrong way through the woods. Because, yeah, there are definitely places like that that are no fun whatsoever, but I don't go that way.
Yeah, right.
So
it was, also, he could have just walked the beach.
Yeah, you would have, yeah.
Because by back then, there was no Crescent Harbor. It was a
true,
nice sandy beach.
And I think he probably, it may have been that he walked, and there was a trail through the park, but I think he went out to the old fort site, uh-huh, and then was kind of on the river, but he was also exploring as a naturalist, so then he, yeah, just, I think, thought he would just come back through the forest. And it's interesting to imagine what that would have been like, because this was 100 years, you know, well, it was 40 years before the Americans came, and so there was no Sheldon Jackson campus there. That was probably all forested, like nothing down there other than forest. And who knows what the Russians had logged in the 20 years they'd been here, and mm-hmm, what kind of slash or whatever might have been around there. So it is interesting to think about that. I mean, Sitka's a relatively thin strip of development, but even that, you know, I've tried to walk actually just a couple times recently, I walked, had reason to walk maybe 100 or 200 yards along the shoreline, but couldn't walk on the beach and had to just walk through the trees. It was not fun.
You know, my gosh. Just, well, actually coming back from Lisa Creek.
We managed to find a really awful way. I thought, yeah, oh, hey, we could check this out because it looked okay from the water. It was
and
not
And also
great.
The map. Like, it looked like, you know, a nice shelf, a plateau, and then a little ramp down. And
all those things did exist.
Yeah.
They did exist, but they were also very overgrown and, like, also creek, steep ravines. And
it was very fun.
And then we did finally get down to the shoreline, and we're like, great, you know, this is going to be better. We'll walk the shoreline. But no,
yeah,
we couldn't walk
there
the shoreline.
There were huge cliffs.
You had to go back up into the woods
up and over.
It's all
and
a mess in there.
Grab along the side. And yeah, no, it's, I remember Connor used to tell me, he's like, oh, I just walk along the shoreline. It's pretty easy. I'm like, no. Yeah. You can go one way or the other, but the shoreline is often the worst. If the beach is there, you can walk the beach, but there's an awful lot of places around here where there is no beach. It's just a steep rock. And yeah, and it doesn't get any less steep above the tide line. And so sometimes you end up going up 100 or 200 feet above and over. And yeah, no, not fun, even for a short little jaunt. So,
well, there's one thing I wanted to ask you, Matt, because maybe you'll know something about this, because this happened when we were on the Lisa Creek. It's not about natural history. It's actually just about regular history, human history, I guess. We were on the middle ridge, the summit there, and then we're going to go back to now on the first ridge, I guess. And you can see Cold Storage Lake from that ridge, and we had binoculars, and there was a very large white object. And so we got the binoculars out, and it was at the, what would that be, like the
kind of the outflow
of Cold Storage Lake. And you look through the binoculars, and it's a aircraft of some sort.
Oh.
Like a crash would be, you know. But I can't think of hearing about a crash up there and like a plane that was left or anything like that. So I'm curious if you, cold storage used to be quite a popular place for people to float plane into. I don't think they do anymore. Or what? So anyway, do you have any thoughts or does that spark a memory for you?
I don't have any specific memories. I mean, I think it was probably before I was old enough to be aware, because there's a number of crashes around places. Like there's one below the shelter, Harbor Mountain, down in the valley down there that you can kind of just see parts of. I've never walked down to it, but there's the one going up the backside of Verstovia. There's a plane crash up there. That one I do remember vaguely. I mean, I was old enough to kind of have some awareness of it, but it wasn't anything that I paid a lot of attention to, you know. So it wouldn't surprise me at all that there was a crash in the 60s or 70s or something at cold storage, and once the plane's there, they're not hauling it out. So it's
it's kind of surprising, I guess, to see.
It is interesting. It is interesting how often, you know, you'll feel like, there's nobody else that's ever been here. That would be dumb. Why would anybody else go here? And then you'll find a bit of flagging or something. You're like, okay, well. And that's why I decided, especially talking to people that kind of grew up here and were young males, especially when they were here before the days of GPS. It's like any place you think that you might like to go, somebody's definitely been. And an awful lot of places you'd never dream of going because they just look ridiculous, somebody else has also probably been, because they're like, oh yeah, I can go up that. So, you know, like going up Bear Mountain from Bike where the waterfall is, and just like just going up that, oh yeah, we can totally go up that way. Well, maybe, but but that's you know, young person's game. But yeah, it is kind of remarkable how many places, and then you'll find just weird kind of, and I kind of appreciate finding a little, like I describe them as whimsy, the little whimsical things that people leave, you know, a stack of rocks or whatever. There was up on that uplands between Beaver Lake and Silver Bay this year, I went to a lobe that's kind of closest to Beaver Lake, and I'd never been on that part before this summer, and there was three kind of successive like high spots. They weren't like super high, but they were definitely high spots on that local terrain, and each of them had a rock pile. And you could see from those rock piles down, I don't know if they were, you know, and they'd been there a while, clearly, because there was mosses and lichens growing over them. But I don't know how long, you know, decades, centuries, whatever. I don't know what purpose they might have had. Somebody just had some time to kill, or there was some other thing going on, or, you know, you could see down to the water from there. So presumably you could see up, but I don't know. I think the rock piles were too small to be, like, I don't think I would have seen them from the water, the rock piles themselves, but yeah, it was just interesting to wonder, you know, somebody obviously spent some time piling up these rocks. It wouldn't have taken a huge amount of time, but, you know, I know in some places there's big rock piles. They did a study on them on North Baranof a few years ago. But
yeah, they're indigenous.
Yeah, yeah, and those ones, they were like, were centuries old. These ones were small enough, you know, I don't know how old they were. So it is interesting to just run in, for me at least. I think some people like the idea of being the first ones to someplace. I'm like, well, this is kind of, I don't have that, I guess, that I don't.
And this from the Conservation Society used to say that one of the ways that you can, because wilderness is a concept that we defined. You know, we define wilderness. We choose to believe what is wild and isn't. And he says that one of the measures for wilderness is when you go out there and you find something that's human. If you think, oh, that's trash, someone left that, then that's probably not wilderness. If you find it and you're like, oh, this is amazing that this is here, then it's probably wilderness.
Interesting. Yeah. It's kind of an interesting aesthetic sense to how people do. But it doesn't work the same way as for me as it does for some other people, it seems like. But it is, I mean, I don't like to be around crowded places. Like, I like to go places where it feels like there's not a lot of people around at the time, but I don't mind if people have been there before, kind of thing. So,
well, what I was surprised by was not what humans have left behind on that ridgeline, because like I said, it was only, the highest point was only 3,200 feet, but goats.
Oh, was there a lot of goat hair?
A lot of goat hair.
Oh, nice.
And kind of through the, I guess there was a little one scrambly section where there was a little rocky kind of cliffy climb, and, you know, these low trees you could kind of crawl through, and the goats really had left a lot of fur there, which was fun and unexpected for me. I didn't think they would be there.
Yeah, Well, I wonder, seasonally, you didn't see any goats, though, while you were there?
Mm-mm. No, not at that time.
I wonder what's on that other ridge.
I mean, they're known to be around cold storage. That's one of the reasons people go there.
Right.
But, yeah.
Yeah, it is an interesting to consider, like, what's going around up there. My challenge these days is that I want to look for mosses and liverworts, and that often means like poking around in all the little cracks and crevices of all the rocks. And let's just say you don't go very fast when you're doing that. It's difficult to cover a lot of ground. So, like,
or you could do the climb up and then be on the ridge up at the higher points and find the little rocky places and just stay put there.
Yeah, that's what I'd have to do. But yeah, it starts to be like, well, now it's hard to do that in a day.
You got to bring your tent too. Yeah.
And I didn't bring a tent, or but I did spend the night on Bear Mountain one time this past in early fall, late summer, early fall.
And you have found some liverworts that were not known from North America, right?
Wow. Not as far as I know. I have found some that weren't known from Alaska.
Okay.
Or a moss that was, well, maybe, it there's very few records of this moss, but it's super inconspicuous, so that's not so surprising. But there was some tetraplodon, now I don't remember the species name of it, but yeah, a tiny little moss that I think has maybe a handful of North American records, if that. I think there was one from Adak and maybe a couple other places. I found a liverwort this summer, I'm pretty sure, which is new for Alaska, but also a tiny one. That was actually on Bear Mountain. So I spent the night up there, and then, like, I didn't get up super early, but I got up early enough and still was like up there for 8 hours. I was still coming back, pushing dark, coming back, because it's just like you can fill as much time as you have allotted when you're poking around in rocks and crevices looking for liverworts. And then, of course, I came back with like dozens of collections that I still are sitting in my refrigerator, need to be worked on this winter. So that's winter projects. I have plenty of darkness to do that.
That's right.
Yeah. And so, Paul, I know before we started recording, you wanted to speak. This past year, you were saying you worked on sponges. Kind of fits in with the diving.
Yeah. So to say that I worked on sponges is kind of a generous term, because this researcher from UC Santa Barbara is working on sponges and sponge taxonomy. And he was interested in getting some specimens. And he came up here and we did some diving together. And I've been kind of getting better about labeling and organizing. And I started following on Facebook this group that does mushroom genetics. And I really appreciated how on their end, you know, they're out there, they're getting the ITS sequence, and they're like really, their perspective is it's so much easier for them when they get a really organized box with specimens that are clearly labeled with pictures from the field and so on. And I'm trying to get better and better at this, because I feel like in the past I've had a hard time sending specimens into people and the specimens arriving in a good state and the specimens actually being processed and being included. So I'm doing that this year, sending. There's already been one that he described recently, and it's a sponge that's common in the harbors here. And
yeah, I saw that one. It's like a new to science species that is abundant in Sealing Cove, as best I can tell.
Very abundant in Sealing Cove.
From my naturalist, that's like it's like a fouling organism on the ropes. And so I was like, well, I should go get that one.
Yeah,
yeah. I think if I remember correctly, when he put the IDs on there, he's like, this isn't really identifiable without genetics at this point, but. You know, given that all the observations there in Sealing Cove, and so it seems like it's a fairly safe bet if you go find the rope with the yellow sponge on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So by now I've sent probably 60 specimens of sponges to him. And you've been collecting specimens for fungi and also Jen Shapland. And
yeah.
Juno has been collecting fungi for genetics, and that's maybe part of my project for next year. What do you think about this fungus project?
Yeah, it's great. It's the Mycoflora project. You can sign up for it. They're on iNaturalist. They have a newsletter. I can't remember what they have, a clever little name, but the Mycoflora project is what they call it on iNaturalist. And they have a nice, you print out labels, and ideally you do the have the labels with you in the field, so you do the iNaturalist photo observation in the field. I've never been that prepared, and so I have little bags, and I keep them, so I write on the bags in the field, and then I dry them, and then I've so far only just done the label with the other people, or like have the labels in the field like you're supposed to. But so then you have them dried, and for me, I just put them in the refrigerator in a brown bag, you know, I have just little small brown bags that I collect them in. And so I've written on those, so I know which one they are, which a naturalist observation. And then as long as they're not like super duper fleshy, you put them in the refrigerator and over 2 or 3 weeks, they'll dry. And then I don't have to have the dehydrator, because, you know, that's the way that real mycologists do things, I think, is to put them in the dehydrator and they dry over a couple of days. But that seems to work all right. They've been able to get, and the smallest ones, you don't even need to do that. You can, you know, the little tiny Mycenas or something, they'll just air dry. But so I do that. And then when I get organized this year, after last year, I just sent in what I had and didn't worry about, they had dates for like, oh, this is the fall Michael Blitz or whatever. And I just like, oh, I'm just going to print these. I'm not going to worry about the dates, and send them in. And you can send like $4 a sample or something like that. And so I just send them some money and sent in my collections, and then they process them. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to start doing that. So this year I've been collecting all year, but I haven't gotten around to sending, you know, packaging them up and sending them. So that's on my list. I probably have a couple hundred. So I don't know if I'll send them all in, but I'll have to look and see if they look like they're still in decent condition or something. But they're not keeping them for herbariums so much. They're just doing the DNA on them. So they're not looking to have those be like specimens that stay in a museum somewhere for the most part, as best I can tell. So they're like, oh yeah, if you just, you know, even just part of a cap or whatever, they're trying to catalog the diversity. So it's fungal diversity is kind of the fungus, I guess, that they're cataloging it across North America. And so, yeah, it's an understudied place here. You know, we have all these little brown mushrooms that are like,
all the, like, if you are in the alpine and find a cortinarius.
Yeah. Yeah. There's one that was described that included some of specimens from here. I think one that you and I found on the backside of Verstovia got included as part of the description for that species, Neosanguineus or something like that. Yeah. And there's a bunch of cortinarius and a bunch of russulas here that are difficult to ID morphologically. There's work that's been done in Washington, but several of the ones that I've put in have been like, well, this is one that we don't have, you know, it doesn't look like it's related to anything that's already in the database. So kind of these new, and so they give them provisional names. It's like Alaska One, you know, Peniolis Alaska One or whatever like that. So to just indicate that it's, you know, something in this genus seems to be, and it's from Alaska, and you know, we haven't seen it before. And so then they just increment those numbers each time there's a new in that genus, seems to be different kind of thing. So, and that all shows up in iNaturalist. And so you can do that. And then, yeah, sometimes you get names on them, directly. So it's been nice. And it's, yeah, you're finding these little mushrooms all year round. So it's just easy enough to have them in a bag. As long as you label the bag, then you don't have to deal with them like right away. So it is a good project. I certainly encourage folks to look it up if they're curious about it.
Speaking of Peniolis,
did you find that one when we were in Cordova?
No, I've never found it. We were in Cordova.
Because that's moose.
No, and there are moose. But this fungus grows on moose poop. It's called Peniolis alsis, the moose dung mottle gill. And Peniolis is famous because if you open up their cap, so the hat of the mushroom, like the umbrella part, and you look at the gills, they're blotched. They don't ripen evenly, or like they don't ripen from the cap out or some, you know, like a coprinus or something,
yeah,
or from the outside into the cap. They kind of make spots. And so Peniolis is sort of famous for that characteristic. But this one grows on moose dung. And then there's another fungus that's really popular up north. And then another that grows on moose pea. It's called Bisonectria terrestris. It's super orange and fun, and when the snow melts, you can see it. And these, we were talking about them because of the Mushrooms of Alaska book that you already talked about with Kitty recently.
Yeah, well, at this point, it's been a couple of months. But yeah, Mushrooms of Alaska by Noah Siegel, Kate Mohat, and Steve Trudell. Now out. nice reference. I don't have it myself yet, but you have a copy here. So
you're in it, though.
Yeah, we get a little shout out. Paul right. and Kitty and I, we went out with them. I think we went out on the boat with Noah when he was here.
Yeah.
And certainly was out with Noah and Kate at various times. I was around town, so I guess that's probably why we're in there. But yeah, it was fun to get out with them, and it's been a few years. It's hard to believe time it flies. But speaking of which, we are getting close to the end of our time here. Are there any sort of last things that you all wanted to highlights from your year, or absent that, maybe intentions for next year? I know, well, as this is airing, you all will be somewhere deep in the South, and preparing to go deep, deep South, enjoy a little summer in December.
Here we go.
In January. But yeah.
I'd love to get that other ridge line at Lisa Creek. Maybe that's something we can plan on for 2026.
Maybe start expanding our way up Nakwasina towards the north of Nakwasina and some of those big mountains. And there's a lot of long ridges.
Kind of the ridge by
kind of that area, you know, towards Fish Bay and St. John the Baptist.
So there's endless. Gosh, your list, one's list is endless around here. Yeah,
no end of things to explore. There's kind of a lot of moderate elevation uplands kind of between Nakwasina, Fish Bay, you know, north of Anahuts, that kind of area, open rolling. I don't know. It's probably some of it's really steep. I've been curious even just to get up to the top of Halleck Island and look around for, again, mosses and liverworts or plants.
Well, when you were talking about mosses and liverworts, I thought we need to go. It would be a longer trip, though, but like spend the night kind of thing, but go up to that, the place that Paul and I really enjoyed last year, which was up like on 5390.
Oh,
and you could just poke around in those, you know, those rocks
at
the different... Yeah.
I'd very much like to get up there. That just also the geology looks cool up there, kind of the glacial valley and all that that's probably was glaciated 100 years ago and has retreated, and so opening up and the things coming in there, mysteries abound. Plants, there was our yellow monkey flower, maybe two species here. There's somebody on iNaturalist that's saying this really looks like the one that's, you know, so far been known from the Olympics and Vancouver Island mountains, and maybe it's up here. So it'd be nice to collect some of that, I guess, and get that confirmed by the monkey flower experts and all those kind of things. Yeah, no end of questions and places to explore. And so Lisa Creek, maybe getting up there. I mean, I still haven't been up Cross Mountain since 1990s, so I'd like to go up there and see. Yeah, even this year I was up on Stargavin Ridge and walked just across a little stretch that I hadn't walked before, kind of going up from the upper lake to the ridgeline. And I found a bunch of both Pyrola minor, which I don't see very often around here.
Yeah, I think of them as like a mainland plant.
Yeah, and I've seen it elsewhere on Stargavin Ridge. I think, Paul, you were the first one that I know that found it up there. But there was also a Batrachium there that I hadn't seen before. And so I was like, and I've literally been on Stargavin Ridge a bunch of times, dozens of times.
Batrachium is notoriously, it's there and then it's not there.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. But this is a place, I mean, it was a little pocket of meadow that I just walked through that I hadn't walked on before. And then, you know, there was these different plants. And I was like, and this is a ridge I've been on a lot. So, you know, that's part of what keeps me getting out again is all that kind of thing. But, appreciate y'all coming in. And maybe we can do this again in a year from now and see what adventures you've been up to in the meantime.
Yeah, see you in a year. And we'll have to hear about your adventures.
All right.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded with Brooke Schaefer and Paul Norwood earlier in December. I want to thank them for joining me again for my Year in Transition show, and thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can get on my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a comment there. As we transition into the new year, I hope you're having a good winter season and look forward to coming back in 2026. Until then, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.